Vaccine injury compensation program is a cornerstone of the U.S. immunization system, and it's really been helping assure a supply of vaccines that are safe and effective for the last 23 years. It's not as well known as other aspects of the immunization system in the U.S., but if it weren't for the VICP, we wouldn't be enjoying the successes that the programs are enjoying today. Jeff Evans is the director of the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, and it's a position he's held since 2004. In addition to vaccine liability and injury compensation programs, both here and abroad, Dr. Evans, who's a pediatrician, has written on vaccine safety and communication and communicating the risks and benefits of vaccination, and he's co-authored the 1995 IOM report on the Vaccine Safety Forum Workshop and Vaccine Risk Communication. Let us welcome Dr. Jeff Evans.
Good afternoon. I want to thank Jeannie and Lance for inviting me. These feature presentations are rare slots, and we always enjoy the opportunity to try to explain the program. It could very well be, I may be wrong, but it could very well be that our program, which has operated quietly for most of the 20 years, has gotten a little bit more attention recently, but maybe that's just a coincidence. So they wrote down the title of my talk, the VICP, a critically important, and I added in yet confusing, component of the nation's immunization program. And so to start about the confusing part, so exactly a year ago, the good folks at American Medical News had this little item here, which pretty much people are aware of, having to do with a so-called vaccine court ruling, which of course it was not. It had nothing to do with the vaccine court, but the basic premise was correct. The government had decided to compensate a case of a child, Hannah Poling, who's now well known, who was supposedly injured by vaccines and who had some form of autism. And this, I'm sure, made your day and made your work quite difficult or more difficult. And that was something that gave me some sleepless nights, knowing that for such a long time we had been trying to make the immunization program successful, and suddenly we were a little bit of an anchor on it. But the story did change, and we all know that nearly a year later, the New York Times had this editorial, as did incredible number of media outlets, and that reflected the first in a series of decisions that came out of the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, which in this particular editorial had good news and not so good news and hopeful news, and that is that we had a very definitive, incredibly definitive set of rulings, but yet there's still a very strong group of activists and parents who feel that the science is not correct, but there's hope that the vast majority of parents still will believe that vaccines are not related to autism. So what brought about the program? I think it's important to step back 20, 25 years, and it'll explain exactly what it is that we're doing, why it is that we're doing what we're doing, and how we came about. So some of you may recall that in the 1980s, DTP vaccine was being given, and of course DTP had a lot of side effects, swollen arms, redness, fever. Half the kids had fever, infants, and those that are predisposed to seizures often had their initial seizure event and so on. So Lee Thompson, who was a reporter for the local affiliate WRC in Washington, put together a piece called DPT Vaccine Roulette, made the Today Show, and then we're off to the races. Other media picked this up, and her piece was particularly worrisome because it had beating hearts, red colors, and showed severely psychomotor retarded children that were supposedly all related to DTP vaccine. The lawyer soon got involved with lots of lawsuits. The price of vaccine skyrocketed. And most of the companies decided that because of the liability burden, it wasn't worth staying in the marketplace. So they began to exit, and by 84, we had a real shortage of DTP vaccine, with CDC calling for vaccine rationing. I was in practice at the time and was well aware of this. And there was a demand to do something, and that something was the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 86, which had some very clear public policy goals of ensuring that the supply of vaccines remain stable and adequate, that vaccine costs would stabilize, and that there would be a accessible and efficient no-fault compensation system. And this was particularly important because those that were going into the tort system at the time and alleging the injury from DTP and asking for tens of millions of dollars, were either given nothing or were awarded incredible sums of money. So there was a real inconsistency, and there was difficulty because often they didn't have lot numbers and so on. So there was this was not a good vehicle for them to be able to obtain compensation for what they thought were vaccine-related injuries. So in setting up this, Congress devised a compromise mechanism known as the vaccine injury table, which would list certain conditions and time frames if satisfied, would allow a presumption that the vaccine caused it, because in the tort system, in these civil court cases, often there were these battles about what is vaccine caused and not vaccine caused. So this would be avoided by having this, at least in this one of the mechanisms of vaccine injury table. And that the procedures would be relaxed in terms of rules of evidence, and discovery would not be part of it, although that did change a little bit later, as I'll get into. There would be no restrictions on who could file or file on behalf of, but you must first file with the federal system before and reject either compensation or reject the decision, so to speak, that's a legalism, before going out and suing either a vaccine company or a vaccine provider or administrator, I should say, or both. So, and Congress laid out this framework of terms of participants. You would have Health and Human Services, HRSA, specifically the agency in HHS, who would administer the program. By administer, we would be reviewing the medical records and affidavits filed with the claims, and also would be administering payments to petitioners and attorneys. The Department of Justice would be representing the HHS in front of a special court known as the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. It sits right across the White House. It hears suits against the United States government. And this particular program would be decided at the first level by a group of individuals called special masters, who are specially appointed attorneys who work under judges of the court. And they would be the final decision maker on both entitlement to compensation as well as damages. This is the only federal compensation program that has a judicial model. All the rest are administrative in the executive branch, such as black lung and radiation and so on. But because of the intense controversy around vaccine causation, no surprise there, the consumers that were part of the negotiations with Henry Waxman's staff insisted that there be an independent body making these decisions, thus a judicial model, and thus we have attorneys and an adversarial framework. These are the vaccines that are covered. The first seven, which means the first three bullets, were what the program started with. These were vaccines that were mandated in many states. The thinking being that if society is going to require immunizations to be given to children, that untoward events, unexpected events should be, some of the compensation should be, the burden of paying that should be placed on society. So these were the vaccines initially put on the list, and then through a mechanism of adding additional vaccines, i.e. those that are recommended for routine administration of children by CDC, the remaining vaccines were added over a period of 15 years. As you can see, there's been a fair amount of activity since 2004. The biggest of them being influenza, because once influenza was added, influenza is given in the tens of millions of doses, so that certainly had the potential for bringing in lots of claims. So, in order to receive compensation, you have to demonstrate one of three things. Either that there's a table injury, a table condition that's listed, and you satisfy the interval. And then if that's true, then you receive a presumption that the vaccine caused the condition, or you have to prove if it's a non-table condition or off the table in terms of intervals, then you must prove vaccine causation. And much, much less frequently, there's proof of significant aggravation. For example, a child who has a seizure condition and gets a vaccine and has double the number of seizures, that would be an example of aggravation, or a child with a metabolic disorder, for example. The standard of proof is the same as in the civil courts, what's called preponderance of the evidence standard, which is 50% in a feather. And the effects must last more than 6 months, which is pretty standard for compensation programs around the world. But there was a kind of a new twist added in Congress in 2000 because of the rotavirus and the susception kids who would undergo surgery and yet have really no lasting effects, but yet certainly deserve some form of compensation. So an additional criteria that you have to have inpatient hospitalization and surgical intervention was added. So let me just step you through the process a little bit. You don't need a lawyer, but most people do use an attorney. You file a petition, and the filing deadlines are 3 years for an injury and 2 years for a death, or within 4 years of the onset of the injury, which leads to a death. And the supporting documents are pretty straightforward: medical records, affidavits from family members or parents, and expert witness reports, because this involves sometimes hearings in the need of experts. Our office has a modest staff of about 6 pediatricians and a general adult person, and they review the records and see if one of those 3 criteria are satisfied: table injury, causation, or significant aggravation, and we come up with a recommendation on entitlement to a compensation. That is, so if we do find that there's evidence, then we will concede entitlement to compensation. That's a concession. We then transmit our opinion over to the Department of Justice. They perform a legal analysis. They combine the two, and they send that on to the court. And that's known as a Rule 4 report. And the reason I get this particularly tedious in my description is because it was the Rule 4 report that was leaked to the media in the Hannah Poland case. And that had never happened before. So that was a little lesson learned for us. Continuing on, if we do recommend for entitlement, if we do concede entitlement, that usually leads to compensation. Court is more than happy to go along and stamp our approval, stamp their approval of our concession, and assuming the legal requirements are met vis-a-vis the DOJ review. But if we do not find that it satisfies those 3 criteria, then there can be a hearing, and there's expert witnesses, and the families will testify, and it's up to the court to decide whether compensation is appropriate. And if it does so, that's a decision to compensate the case, not a concession. So the Hannah Poland case was a concession, whereas many times the court will decide, and we will defend, and the court will decide on their own. A special master's decision can be appealed to a judge of the court, or if you're not happy with that outcome, you can go on to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, and that's the important one, because that's precedent setting, and that has had a great deal of effect on our program over the past 20 years. And if you're not happy with that result, you can go on to the Supreme Court, and we did actually have one case that was brought by the government to the Supreme Court, and the secretary had a unanimous decision in favor of him, I should say. Awards are paid through a trust fund. That's that vaccine excise tax. It's 75 cents on each dose or disease prevented. So DTaP, which prevents 3 diseases, has a $2.25 excise tax. And the trust fund has grown a little bit over the years, and it used to be that people would be very impressed to hear that it has $3.0 billion, but now, of course, a billion really doesn't mean very much. I guess if I said it had $3 trillion, that would be more impressive. But it's growing. It's grown a lot recently because of influenza. If you have 125 million doses, you can do the math and see that that's by itself 75 million or so that's coming in alone. And the outlays are usually in about the $100 million range annually. So we are netting about $150, $170 million a year. If you are found compensable by either a concession or a decision by the court, the injuries usually result in a lump sum and an annuity, which provides a lifetime stream of benefits. It covers non-economic damages, which are capped at $250,000. And there's also unlimited lost wages and attorney fees and costs. And they are reviewed by the Department of Justice. The court will settle any disputes on that, but they have to be documented. And of course, fees are paid if the claim is brought on a good faith and reasonable basis, regardless of whether the family or individual is compensated. So that's a unique feature. No other compensation program in the world has that. It does encourage the participation of attorneys in the U.S. Court of Claims Bar, because even though they may have to wait a long time to get compensated, it's not like a contingency fee system where if you don't prevail, then you don't get paid. So this is an incentive for attorneys to participate. See, you never knew these things, did you? So this particular slide is because I only have 25 minutes to talk. So normally this is about 3 or 4 slides worth, and what I'd like to do is just quickly squeeze in 20 years worth of experience. So I broke it into 3 phases. And the first phase is when the doors opened. And that day, there were the claims were judged either pre-88 or post-88, pre-88 being for all the vaccines that were given prior to the program starting. And so there was a 2-year deadline to get those in, and lo and behold, 4,200 claims came in. One going back to 1918, dozens from the 30s and 40s, and so on. It took about 14 years to adjudicate them, but they were adjudicated under the original table, which had things such as seizures under DTP, had shock collapse under DTP, and these were the conditions that Congress originally put in the table, but did a couple things. It mandated that the Institute of Medicine look at the scientific and medical literature and report back to the Secretary so the table could be modified. And that process was ongoing in the first phase from 88 to 94. And then we go in, and then when the IRM reports were available, then the Secretary could make changes. So that's the second phase in which the reports that were released in 91 and 94, the changes were made to the table. Conditions were removed, such as seizures and shock collapse. Things were added to the table, such as thrombocytopenia under measles-containing vaccines and bronchial neuritis under tetanus-containing vaccines. And new vaccines were added also, about 5 or 6 vaccines were added, but with few, if any, conditions, because after all, if a vaccine is licensed by our friends at FDA, they're not going to license it with a serious adverse event that's already been found. So it's only after post-marketing experience and time has passed that we really can determine for sure whether there's an adverse event, as was the case with intussusception associated with rotavirus vaccine. So we had the pre-88, post-88, and then we go into phase 3, which was where the post-88 program, the current program, also became divided into autism and non-autism. And before I go into a little bit more detail about that, the autism claims, just to reflect upon some of the statistics, such as altogether now there are 13,000 claims that have been filed. So that's 4,200 of the older claims. That's 5,500 autism claims. So you're left with about 3,000 non-autism, more current claims. And that, over 20 years, that breaks down to about 110, 120 a year. And we get about 140, 150 non-autism claims filed. These days, mostly for MMR, HPV, actually in order, it would be influenza is now the most, HPV next, and then probably MMR. So sliding down in terms of percentage. But in terms of the way that why claims are compensated, over the past 5 years, it breaks down to about concessions. Our office looking at the claims saying this does fit under the program. And mostly our concessions would be things like thrombocytopenia after MMR, or bronchial neuritis after tetanus-containing vaccine, some encephalopathy after MMR or DTaP, so on. These are the kinds of conditions that we would concede based on what's listed on the table. Much more rarely is it based on causation. You can see that the court, where we have decided to defend, the court has compensated about a quarter of these claims. And then increasingly we are settling claims, and I will get into that in a couple minutes as to why that is. And overall, the individual award average is about $1 million. Again, that pays a lifetime stream of benefits. So in the end, it could be $8 million, $10 million, $15 million over the course of an individual's lifetime or more. And the single largest award to date was recently, and that was $13 million. And that was basically an adolescent who there were lost wages thrown in terms of continued care for the rest of his life and so on. And that was an expensive annuity. But that gives you an example of the range. Up to that point, I think the most expensive claims we've had have been children with ventilators for OPV, for VAP. You know, with the young kids, 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds, who have a lot of care expenses ahead. So, all right. So, Andrew Wakefield publishes his paper in 1998 in The Lancet, and then the PHS comes along in 1999 and has its statement on thimerosal, and then suddenly we have some attorneys that are interested in putting forward some theories, and we have the beginnings of what has turned out to be a unique and extremely large and ambitious undertaking known as the Omnibus Autism Proceeding. And they came alleging that autism or autism spectrum disorder was caused by either MMR vaccine, the Wakefield hypothesis, or by thimerosal in non-MMR vaccines. And so the court created this proceeding, and they also did a couple things that the Department of Justice objected to, but so far has continued on and will continue on. And that is that they decided to use short form petitions. Under the statute, you have to file medical records with specific allegations of vaccine and date of onset and provide medical records and all that. But because of the enormous numbers of claims that were heading in, the court decided to not do that and just require petitioners to file one-page short-form petitions just with a filing fee, and no medical records were necessary. So that's the bulk of the 5,000-plus claims we have right now, although since 2007, they have been requiring medical records to be filed with them. And they put together a two-phase process. Discovery took 5 years. Remember, there's no discovery in the vaccine compensation program. Now there was discovery. So for 5 years, CDC, FDA, and vaccine companies put together hundreds of thousands of pages of documents. And as that began to trail to an end, then we headed into some hearings starting in 2007. And there were three general theories of causation. The first set of hearings in 2007 concerned the combined theory, which is one that we thought that was a throwaway theory, but that actually turned out to be their first one, and that was that a combination of MMR vaccine as well as thimerosal-containing vaccines caused the autism or autism spectrum disorder, the thimerosal causing an immune system dysfunction, and the MMR virus then having the opportunity to go and infect the brain. So this was their theory one. The thimerosal-only theory hearings and test cases, three test cases for each theory, took place in July and May of 2008. And then there was going to be a third theory, just MMR only, but petitioners decided that they would just use the evidence they had in their first theory in their 2007 hearings. So the decisions that came down in February of last February concerned the theory one and now theory three, and that was the combination as well as MMR vaccine only. The court ruled definitively against petitioners in all three test cases, and appeals, the petitioners have 30 days to file appeals to a judge of the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. Remember that back on that slide before. So right now, three judges have been assigned one test case each. The government, their briefs have been filed. The petitioners' briefs are filed. Government has until April 15th to respond, and then one oral argument's date has been set of July 29. It could very well be that we will not have the answers, the rulings on the appeals until late 2009 or sometime in 2010. It's not clear. And of course, we still are awaiting the decisions in the Theory 2 test cases from 2008, and those. The briefing period for those is still open and will close midsummer. So depending on the court could come out within just a couple months after that, but nothing is certain. These took a lot longer than anyone expected, and of course appeals will be filed by the party that does not prevail in those. So just a couple words about challenges. Because The vaccine table has been modified over the years with new vaccines added with relatively few conditions. We've gone from the situation in which the predominant vaccine in the first phase was DTP, 75% were DTP. The table was the initial table with all those conditions. But over time, with the modifications of the table, but more importantly with two things, with the fact that we've added all these new vaccines with relatively few conditions, and the fact we've transitioned from DTP to DTAP and OPV to IPV, petitioners now find themselves in a situation where most of them have to pursue a causation effect case, and that's much more burdensome, and compensation has been was much more difficult. So the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals stepped in 2005, 2006 in a series of decisions. Again, remember the precedent-setting bunch. And they decided that the standard of causation was too difficult. So they came up with a set of criteria for the special masters to use in deciding causation. And that is that there has to be a reasonable medical theory, a logical sequence of cause and effect, and temporality that certainly is scientifically consistent. And has turned out to be a much less burdensome proposition for petitioners. And things such as multiple sclerosis and hepatitis B vaccine has made that threshold. Optic neuritis and measles containing vaccine. There's a whole series of vaccines and demyelinating conditions that the court now feels, based on this relaxed standard, can be compensable and has been, they have compensated them. So we find ourselves in a position that we defend fewer of the cases in some of these demyelinating conditions and settle instead. And that's the reason why, because we have litigative risk and we decide that it's better to go ahead and come to a settlement rather than try to defend and use resources and so on. And the only other challenge would be we have 5,000 claims and we're going to need to perform medical reviews at some point on them, even if certainly some of them, no matter which way the decisions go. And that gets into a long story, but those cases will not go away automatically just because the court decides that those two theories are not viable. There could be a third theory, such as mitochondrial disorders, for example. Quickly, just in terms of public policy outcomes, 2,200 families have been compensated. Certainly many of them would not have been able to bring their cases in state courts, and with a more generous, relaxed framework of the table, presumptions and so on, they were more likely to be compensated. The process improvements seem to have worked very well in the program, maybe models for a drug compensation program in the future, who knows. Certainly there's a much more stable marketplace with lots of new products. And for non-autism cases in the private sector, in the civil sector, there's no question, and you see DTP, DTAP as the marker here, but there's no question, especially with surveys of companies in the background, that the litigation has reduced dramatically and the program has served as a very successful alternative to the tort system for all the vaccines that are covered. And finally, these are a couple of the areas that there might be some future changes. I would draw your attention. I don't think adult vaccines, the influenza, now that it's recommended for children and being covered by the program, was the big pull towards getting adult vaccines but covered. But I don't think that there's much of a case for pneumococcal polysaccharide. But I think maternal immunization products are one that you might see covered by the program in the future. The idea being that since the mother receives the shot, it's not clear if the baby's protected, because it's usually the vaccine recipient that can file. But that's something that might be that needs legislation, as do all these things. And there's been some tort reform measures, because there are lawsuits. There's loopholes in our law about the autism claims. There's still hundreds of autism suits in the civil courts who trying to get around our program that are waiting to see what happens with our program. And there might be also some legislation in the future about maybe amending the standard of causation. Because when Congress created the program, it created a table program. It did not anticipate an off-table program. So that's one of the things that remains a challenge. And I think I will stop here and ready to answer questions as you'd like.
Well, that was great. What a tour de force talk. So we have time for a couple questions, and so come on up, and both of these talks are open for questions right now.
Can I go ahead? Hi, I'm Lisa Randall from Immunization Action Coalition. I really thank both speakers, very informative. I'm super admiring of what you've done in New Jersey, and we've been cheering you on in our quiet Minnesota way. Dr. Evans, just kind of an easy question about the compensation of the attorneys. It was news to me that they get paid out of the fund, and I'm kind of happy to hear that it makes sense. On appeal, do they continue to get paid out of the fund, or is that out of the family's pocket?
Yes. I didn't mention that part. I probably just left that up semi-purposely. Yes. Attorney fees and costs, if they're, as long as they're documented, the attorneys will continue to get paid as long as they bring appeals and so on, assuming that the case is brought on a good faith and reasonable basis. There's a little bit of a caveat there, because if a case, for example, in the autism proceeding turns out not to be jurisdictionally sound, then there will not be attorney fees paid. So there's good news and not so good news as far as that particular part of it.
I'm Stan Schaefer from Rochester, New York, and my question is actually for Angela Soros. More of a little bit of a perspective about the religious exemption. When you inquired about getting a clarification from your Deputy Attorney General about the religious exemption, it actually sort of opened the floodgates there in terms of allowing a philosophical exemption to appear as a religious exemption. In New York, I'm a pediatrician, and I remember some time back seeing a family who claimed a religious exemption, because in New York also there's no philosophical exemption allowed. And they claimed a religious exemption, and so I contacted our county health director to ask about this. What constitutes a religious exemption? He didn't know, and referred me to the state attorney general's office, and I contacted them. And they told me, you know, that for New York, it would be a letter on letterhead from a religious authority, a priest, minister, rabbi, imam, or some religious authority stating that there is a religious, reason that this particular child can't be immunized. And for states that are, that have sort of vague language for a religious exemption, I think it's important to be proactive and try to get a clarification from the state attorney general's office to exactly what that entails. Is it just a letter from the parents? Is it something from some sort of religious authority? Because that can make a huge difference. And I just wondered what your thoughts were about that.
I agree with you. That's exactly what needs to happen. I can say that in New Jersey, that the reason that the rule was written the way that it was, putting in that language of the bona fide tenets, bona fide practices or tenets, was in order to, we thought, to enhance the statute, to give it a little more clarity and to give it a little more bulk. But it turned out that over the years, that particular phrasing became the problem. It just became problematic. And it became so difficult that at one time, we were pushing back onto the school nurses and the school districts to contact their legal counsel and let their legal counsel interpret it, because we could not get the support we wanted from our legal counsel. Eventually, things came to a head, just as you heard in the presentation, to where we were forced to go back to the statute. So you have to go back to what the foundation is for the rule. And for what you're saying in New York, there has to be a statute that is the basis upon which what those individuals are telling you is from which it's coming. And you need to know what that is. Ask for the citation. What's the statutory citation that supports what they're saying? They have to give you that. And with that, you can go to, a law library, or you can have your attorney pull that statute up and review it, and then you can see for yourself what the statute actually says is required and what constitutes a religious exemption for your state.
Right. So after I got this information, I gave it back to the family and said, well, this is what you need to do for the religious exemption. They said, oh, it's okay, we'll get our kids immunized.
Well, there you go.